hair covered in a hijab. Her baby was dressed up in a Santa hat. She said people in the West Bank like to celebrate each other's holidays. And a lot of Palestinians told me it felt like a breath of fresh air to come out and celebrate after a very bleak few months.
People of all religions coming together. I mean, that sounds pretty special.
Yeah, I think it's maybe you could say it's a rare occurrence when you're looking at the entire region here in the Middle East. But yes, there were Christians and Muslims together taking selfies in front of the large Christmas tree. It was a cause for celebration.
We've been speaking with journalist Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem, telling us about the scene in Bethlehem where Christmas celebrations are going on, even though there have been concerns of violence and the place being targeted this Christmas Day. Daniel, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And let's turn now to our series, Journey Home. It's about the places the presidential candidates in this country got their start. In this encore airing, we focus on Marco Rubio, who at age 44 is the youngest candidate in the 2016 presidential field. The Florida senator is a rising star in the Republican Party, and his roots are planted in a small city just outside Miami. NPR's Greg Allen visits the community that helped shape Marco Rubio, West Miami, Florida.
It's less than a square mile, a tight-knit community of just over 6,000 people. This is where Marco Rubio grew up.
Make a right here, and that'll take you to City Hall.
Tanya Rosio has lived in West Miami for nearly 50 years. She shows me around the town she calls a little gym. There's the park and the recreation center where the community holds Christmas shows, Halloween parties, and 4th of July celebrations. Palm trees line the streets. Most homes are modest, one-story stucco, many brightly colored. Rosio points out others that have been renovated and expanded.
The houses now, people are putting a second story on there. Instead of moving somewhere else, they want to stay within here.
That's what Rubio did. He lives in one of those updated houses with his wife and four children. West Miami is where 30 years ago, Rubio's mother and father put down roots. They came to the U.S. for economic reasons before the Cuban Revolution, when dictator Fulgencio Batista held power. After 5 years in Las Vegas, they moved to West Miami in the 1980s. It was a blue-collar town where nearly all residents were Cuban-American. For high school, Rubio left the neighborhood to pursue a passion. Long before he was interested in politics, he was enthralled by another hard-hitting game, football. He attended South Miami High School. In the 80s and early 90s, the South Miami Cobras were a football powerhouse. At South Miami, Rubio started just one game.
He was a safety on our defense.
Otis Collier was Rubio's coach.
He was a very knowledgeable kid. He always was in the right position. The thing that helped him, he was a smart kid. He played smart.
Rubio was one of the smaller players on the team, but he had a knack for reading offenses and pass patterns. South Miami's athletic director at the time, James Colsey, says Rubio learned a lot on the gridiron, also useful in politics.
Strategies, how to not necessarily to manipulate people, but to how to anticipate.
There are qualities Rubio put to use back home in tiny West Miami, where campaigning is less about strategy and more about personal connections. In 1997, at the age of 26, and a year after graduating from the University of Miami with a law degree, he decided to run for a seat on West Miami's City Commission. One of the first people Rubio went to see was one of his mother's friends, who also happened to be the town's mayor, Rebecca Sosa. She was outside stringing up her Christmas lights.
This young boy came and told me, "Are you the mayor, Rebecca Sosa?" "Yes." "Listen, I want to run for office, and everybody tells me that if you don't help me, I'm not going to win."
It was the beginning of his meteoric political rise. By the next day, Sosa was walking door to door with him. One of the city commissioners he was running to replace was longtime West Miami resident Tanya Rosio, our tour guide from the beginning of the story. In West Miami, candidates' political affiliations aren't listed on the ballot, but Rubio had the support of the powerful local Republican Party. Rosio, now a Rubio supporter, recalls a conversation with a friend whose family was active in local Republican politics.
She says, "I'm sorry, but I have to vote for him because this is our golden boy. And I think he's going to go places." And they pushed him into West Miami. And from then on, it's just history.
But Rubio had his sights set beyond his hometown. Just 1 year after winning that election, he took a shot at a seat in the state legislature. To win, he'd have to broaden his political base and gain support in nearby Hialeah, a town with 40 times as many people as tiny West Miami. So he went to see one of the most influential political figures in town, Modesto Perez.
I work con Marco Rubio, Rebecca Sosa, Senador René García.
The walls of his office are covered with old campaign signs, commendations, and lots of photos. But the 74-year-old Perez isn't an elected official. He runs a refrigeration repair company. In this predominantly Cuban-American city, he's been something of a political godfather, pulling strings for Republican candidates he likes, opposing Republicans and Democrats he doesn't. When Rubio came to see him, Perez says he was impressed by the young man's vision and charisma. Perez soon was spreading the word about the young politician he would call his godson. Rubio narrowly won that seat in the legislature and headed to Tallahassee, the state capital. Through an interpreter, Perez says, Rubio still had a lot to learn.
Marco es tímido como empezó, ¿no? Como muchacho es tímido.
Cuando empezó era tímido.
Sí, tímido.
So Marco was shy when he started.
Entonces dice, me va a dar la...
Perez tells a story from when Rubio was Speaker of the Florida House and came back to the district to hand out Thanksgiving turkeys. Rubio's staff had made arrangements to give away 40 donated turkeys. Perez says he was outraged.
And Modesto says, what do you mean only 40 turkeys? So he sees the trucks coming with the turkeys, and he's like, no, you're going to give
how?
Me...
40, no, ridículo. No.
So you're going to give me 300 turkeys.
300. Okay.
Perez says he helped Rubio understand how to use his political clout to help people. As a legislator, it's a lesson Rubio took to heart, delivering millions of dollars to his district for hospitals, parks, and flood control. By the time he was House Speaker, though, and began developing aspirations for higher office, Rubio stopped requesting earmarked funds for projects back home. Ralph Arza is a Republican from Miami who served in the legislature with Rubio when he was Speaker. Arza says Rubio ran Republican leadership in the Florida House like a sports team, and it was clear who was the most valuable player.
One time he says to me, just open up the court and give Michael the ball. And it was giving him the ball.
Michael, as in Jordan. It's a team from which Arza eventually was cut. After Arza used a racial epithet in phone messages left for a political opponent, Rubio told him he had to resign from the House. From the time he entered politics, Arza says, Rubio always had his eye on the long game.
He had a blueprint of where he wanted to go, and he knew the options and he knew the challenges along the way. He always was playing the game looking down the field.
That was something he first learned in West Miami. Now from his hometown, he's once again looking downfield, this time with his sights set on the White House. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
And let me just encourage you to listen to All Things Considered later today. Our colleagues there are focusing on another presidential candidate, Santa Claus. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 8:18. Thanks for tuning into Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll have the latest news coming up next from NPR and WPR. And you can always follow the news throughout the day online at WPR.org.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
Radical robots and gadgets galore. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support science exploration and education. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Tensions between Iraq and Turkey are continuing over Turkish troops stationed at a base near Mosul. NPR's Peter Kenyon says Iraq's defense ministry says a promised withdrawal has yet to materialize.
The Russian TASS news agency quotes an Iraqi defense ministry spokesman as saying, in fact, there is no Turkish troop withdrawal. There are just statements from Ankara. Turkey agreed to withdraw soldiers and tanks from the Bashika base after complaints from Baghdad and urging from Washington. But Iraq says the partial relocation is far from a withdrawal.
NPR's Peter Kenyon. Shopping this holiday season has been slow for brick-and-mortar retailers. They've offered big discounts and extended hours to lure customers to stores. But NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports online shopping has been booming.
This really was a breakout year for web sales. Traditional brick-and-mortar operations saw traffic and sales declines really throughout the holiday shopping season, while online retailers saw huge volume. That volume created problems for the shipping companies, which hadn't forecast such a big season. We shall see whether the volume translated into healthy sales. The National Retail Federation will announce its holiday sales data in the middle of next month.
NPR's Yuki Noguchi. Wall Street is closed today for the Christmas holiday. In an abbreviated session yesterday, the Dow lost 50 points, closing at 17,552. The Nasdaq Composite rose 2. This is NPR.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. An atheist group is questioning whether Republican legislator improperly used state resources to produce a Christmas greeting video in which he appears to encourage people to become Christians. Representative Scott Allen of Waukesha posted a video on the Wisconsin Assembly's GOP YouTube channel last week. In the video, he invites anyone who is not Christian to consider the hope offered by the Prince of Peace. He goes on to quote several Bible verses. The Freedom From Religion Foundation sent a letter yesterday to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss complaining that Allen is overtly proselytizing. The foundation notes it's unclear whether the state resources were used to produce or distribute the video, but includes a request for all production-related documents. Allen and a Voss spokeswoman did not immediately return email messages yesterday. The El Nino weather pattern that has made much of the country basking in unseasonable temperatures has forced some outdoor skating rink operators to get creative. In Eau Claire, city parks officials kicked off a series of El Nino open skate events yesterday, where indoor rinks will be free at designated times over the next few weeks instead of the normal $3 charge. The city typically has up to 9 outdoor rinks, but the warm weather has made it impossible for them to freeze over. City Superintendent of Recreation Don Cumpty says the outdoor rinks probably will not be usable until mid-January. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Pandora, now also featuring Serial Season 2. Sarah Koenig takes listeners through one true story episode by episode. More at pandora.com/serial or by searching Serial in the Pandora app. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come. On the web at rwjf.org. And from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting Wikipedia and the Digital Public Library of America through its Universal Access to Knowledge program, working to facilitate the openness and accessibility of all knowledge at sloan.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green. Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle. They were the last two films from writer-director David O. Russell. They earned 18 Oscar nominations between them, and they also had something in common, the team of Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper. All of this explains why there is so much anticipation for the new film, Joy. Morning Edition and Los Angeles Times film critic Kenneth Turan has this review.
David O. Russell's best films are thrilling high-wire acts that run the moment-to-moment risk of tumbling to the ground. In his latest, Joy, Russell has more trouble than usual keeping his balance on the wire. Joy is based, albeit loosely, on the life of Joy Magnano, an entrepreneur, inventor, and QVC shopping network star with the mega-selling Miracle Mop. Jennifer Lawrence is excellent as Joy, but the film starts off on the wrong foot, with woeful depictions of her background as the only sane person in her dysfunctional family. Then Joy has a eureka moment while, no surprise, cleaning up someone else's mess. She envisions a mop like nothing else on the market. She makes it and tries unsuccessfully to sell it at a supermarket parking lot.
Well, it's the only mop you'll ever have to buy. Hi, would you like to try a new mop?
No.
It's still ringing. You can remove the mop head, throw it in the washing machine. No germs.
No.
No. No? You want to just try it? You can just try it. And self-ring, see? No other mop does this.
Things get better when Joy hears about a televised way to sell products and makes a connection with QVC. She convinces an executive there, played by Bradley Cooper, to let her appear as herself.
This is me.
This is you? You've got the exact same outfit you had when you came in here.
I wear a blouse and I wear pants. That's who I am. I want to go on as me.
I want to go on as you. I hope you make it back.
Joy even gets to spend some quality time with Joan Rivers, played by her daughter, Melissa.
Joan, Cindy, say good luck to Joy.
Wow, you look great. Good luck today.
Oh, good thank luck. You.
That's her. That's how she is.
Sadly, this picture does not go from strength to strength. It sinks into a morass of tedious obstacles to this woman's success. Joy, the person, may be able to surmount all barriers, but the film with her name on it is not so fortunate.
That's Kenneth Turan. He reviews movies for Morning Edition and for the Los Angeles Times. Well, it is time now for a musical equation. Start with the singer best known for this hit from the late 1980s.
I'm not aware of too many things. I know what I know if you know what I mean.
Add some banjo from a superstar actor and comedian, and somehow you come up with this.
She had a child by that man from the bank.
Edie Brickell and Steve Martin won a Grammy for this song in 2014, and now they are headed for Broadway. NPR's Vince Pearson reports on their new musical, Bright Star.
To begin, let's think back to the 1970s and Steve Martin the comic. You can probably picture him in a white suit with an arrow through his head.
To open the show, I always like to do one thing that is impossible. So right now, I'm going to suck this piano into my lungs.
Even then, the banjo was a big part of the act.
Hey, this guy is good. I'm a random guy.
Martin's five-string was always more than a comedy prop. But in recent years, it's really taken center stage. He did a solo album, and then Edie Brickell approached him to write a song with her. And to her surprise, he sent her a tune. And then another.
And it almost became a game, a fun challenge with music. He always had an idea, and I would bounce one back.
When you get to Asheville, send me an email.
There's so much emotion and drama in the way that he plays banjo and the melodies that he comes up with that I can just picture people in situations, and all I have to do is sing it out.
Ooh, if it don't work out.
And before long, they had an album. And some gigs.
And on the tour bus, we both found that we grew up on musicals and how much we loved them.
That is, of course, Steve Martin.
And I had actually been working on a musical of my own, which I just thought was terrible. And so I put it aside.
And he and Brickell started working together. Martin wrote the story and the music. Brickell wrote the lyrics for a show inspired by their album. Bright Star is set in North Carolina in the 1920s and 40s. It's about a young man who dreams about being a writer, the veteran editor who becomes his mentor, and the tragedy that connects them. It's based on a true story, but Brickell won't say much about that.
Because I think it'll give away too much.
If you need my story, you'd have a good story to tell.
Now, neither Martin or Brickell are in the show, but their personalities do shine through. Brickell says her rural Texas roots really inform these songs.
I grew up in the country a lot as a little girl, so I know all these different characters, and it's easy for me to remember them and let them spark my imagination.
Many backs have broken from lesser weight, I know. I was born to carry more than I can hold.
And then there's that Steve Martin sense of humor.
Daryl and I read your stories.
Yes, I thought they were extraordinary.
Really? Extraordinary?
Oh, sorry, I said that too fast. Extraordinary.
Martin says he worked really hard to get the funny parts just right.
To me, if a one-line joke, a humorous line in the show doesn't work, that's a fiasco. So I'm immediately on it to change it or smooth out or delete it. And it eats away at me if it even remains in for another day.
Never know what life will bring. Only what you bring to life.
But there's no plan to any of this. There's no, now I want to write a musical, now I want this. It's just a serendipity. It's one thing leading to another. An accidental meeting with Edie led to two records and a musical.
Jokes, songs, drama, this is where Steve Martin lives. I asked him if the musical might be the perfect vehicle for his talents.
Well, we'll know after the reviews come out.
Bright Star is playing at the Kennedy Center in Washington. In March, it debuts on Broadway. Vince Pearson, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Christmas Day might not be a big day for news, but there is a political development worth covering. Kris Kringle for president.
You know, I don't like all this questioning.
Nobody likes it, Santa, but it's the system. And when you run for president, you gotta work within the system.
But I'm an outsider.
Underneath our tree, a present for you. Santa for president. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered today at 3 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, I'm David Green. E.T. did it, why not Tim Peake? Last week, the British astronaut called home. His parents were out, so he left a message. Hello, this is your son from the International Space Station. This week, he tried to make another call, but dialed the wrong number. He handled the awkwardness by saying to the woman, hello, is this planet Earth? Peake then tweeted an apology saying it was not a prank, just a wrong number. It's Morning Edition.
Good morning, it's 8:31. Thanks for tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you're having a wonderful Christmas morning so far. Stay with us. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. A Wisconsin writer talks about the confusion his children experienced when they learn about St. Nicholas Day. Hear his journey to explain the tradition while keeping the magic. That's Wisconsin Life in 15 minutes here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Madison, offering nature-themed gifts, binoculars and scopes for bird watching, and Christmas blend bird seed. WBUMadison.com. Discover a refuge in your own backyard.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
As this year comes to a close, please take a few minutes to make a tax-deductible gift to Wisconsin Public Radio today. When you donate, you support the unbiased news, fascinating discussions, and world-class music you've come to rely on. Your year-end gift right now is a powerful vote for smart, vibrant radio, and it starts at WPR.org. Thanks.
It will be mostly cloudy across Wisconsin today. Highs will be in the upper 20s to lower 30s in the north, to the upper 30s to around 40 degrees in the south. Tonight, light snow is likely in the far northwest and far west central Wisconsin after midnight. Lows will be in the mid-20s in the north to the upper 20s and low 30s in the south. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Athena Health. Web-based EHR, revenue cycle management, and population health services. Athena Health. Let doctors be doctors. Learn more at athenahealth.com. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the belief that investing in women and children today ensures a healthy, prosperous future for everyone. More information is available at gatesfoundation.org. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green. Now a story about Iran that cropped up in an unlikely place. Inside this year's huge spending bill on Capitol Hill was a reminder of America's complicated relationship with that country. Tucked among the payments to special interest groups was what you might call a Christmas surprise, a provision that would compensate each of the 53 Americans taken hostage at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in 1979.
It is wonderful that after 36 years, 1 month, 14 days, we've got President Obama signed into law this bill, a piece of justice.
justice for Rocky Sickman. That's his voice there. He and other Americans were held for 444 days during the Iran hostage crisis.
Protesting Iranian students are occupying the American embassy in Tehran. The demonstrators got past Marine guards at the embassy and are now holding hostages.
Rocky Sickman was a 22-year-old Marine sergeant stationed at the U.S. embassy. He spoke to us yesterday from Missouri, and just a warning, some of you might find parts of his story disturbing. Sickman was just getting off work that morning on November 4th when he saw a massive crowd pushing through the embassy gates.
I was walking into the Monopole Gate. David, I'll never forget. My walkie-talkie has recall, which means report back immediately. And I looked at the front gate, and I'll never forget the two Iranian guards that were on guard duty that morning protecting that gate. I take off back to the main embassy building where all of our gear and our weapons are. And Billy Gallegos, one of the other Marines on guard duty that morning, saw me being chased. He allowed me to slip back in. We closed the steel door. And your heart is pounding because everything that you had trained for was now taking place. So Billy calls and says, hey, they've broken through the basement window. And sure enough, I'm the closest to the steps. I run downstairs. And here's Billy and I, 22-year-old Marines, and our orders were don't fire, don't antagonize. And you have no idea, David, after we gave ourselves up that day, it burned. It hurt so bad that you wish that you pulled that trigger that day of November 4th. And obviously that started the next 444 days. And David, 36 years, 1 month, 14 days is when President Obama finally signed that piece of justice.
You literally have counted. I mean, you just set a very specific time frame. You have been counting the days for this moment, it sounds like.
It will never remove the mock firing squads. It will never remove the smells and the sounds. And we went outside seven times out of 444 days. And, you know, the difficulty my poor parents had to go through.
And that, you said mock firing squads? So that's what you had to suffer through?
Oh, yes. Yeah. They, at the very beginning, David, the Iranians, obviously, they were using us as a token. And, you know, they told us this. They said, it's not you, the American people we hate. It's your government. But we will use you to humiliate your government. And they have done it for 36 years. And like I said, I wish that I could have pulled that trigger on November 4th of 1979. But again, being a good soldier, I followed my directions.
That might be a hard thing for some people to hear you say that you wish that you had pulled that trigger and killed some people to prevent, you know, you from having to go through those 444 days.
Yeah, well, trust me, it's you had that on your mind that very first day. And you know what? How Billy and I didn't, you know, go against our orders, how we didn't slip. I mean, as a 22-year-old Marine, that our hormones, our emotions were just fast-paced that morning. And again, we followed our directions. But as you went through that first 30 days being tied and not allowed to speak in the next 400, you just regretted not ever doing it because, you know, at least you would have given them something that you would have liked to have given them. But, you know, again, I followed my directions.
Can I just ask you where you were when you got this news, how you got the news, and what your reaction was?
Yeah, it wasn't until Friday when I was driving down the road that I got word that he did sign it. Because this whole piece of this bill has been, it was like being held hostage. Because every day they'd say, yeah, things are getting closer. And bills would come and then they would leave. And so you didn't believe it. And all of a sudden I got the word and I pulled over and I cried on the side of the road, just the emotions of everything that's taken, you know, through the whole piece. I mean, it was very, very difficult. And obviously there's still a lot of work yet to be done, David. But, you know, it was a piece within, you know, myself. And then also, like I said, for the difficulty of my parents and 8 men lost their life in a rescue operation also. And it was very difficult knowing that those individuals were lost to save my freedom.
Do you know how much money you'll be getting?
You know, the number is out there. I think it was $10,000 a day, which is a formula that has been used So I think it's about $4.4 million. But again, we will be paying, obviously, the attorney fees and everything else. But a lot of work has still got to be done here. And when it happens, it'll be wonderful.
What would you do with the money?
Well, obviously, my wife and I would do a lot of different things. I work for a wonderful company that we give back to military men and women. And I mean, it's just, there's a lot of things that we want to do, and it's going to be difficult to really figure out what until the time comes. But right now, life continues as it was before.
It does sound like the kind of news that that would be great anytime, but especially around the holidays. What a wonderful present to get.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. And, you know, it's wonderful, like I said, to be with my family and be able to share the news. You know, we spent two Christmases over in Iran, never knowing if we would ever be back with our loved ones. And, you know, here we are. And it's something that, as we continue to talk about the men and women that serve our country, we shouldn't forget about those men and women each and every day.
Well, Sergeant Sickman, it's been a pleasure, and have a great Christmas.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Marine Sergeant Rocky Sickman, one of the 53 Americans held hostage in Iran. This is NPR News.
It's 8:41, and you've tuned in to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR, so stick around. And then in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report, consumer electronics are front and center when it comes to big-ticket holiday items, with sales of new gadgets seeing a big bump during the holiday months. But what can companies do to make sure their newest toy moves from a fad to a year-round favorite? Find out how in 10 minutes.
Whether you enjoy classical holiday music, great stories told by some of your favorite NPR personalities, or welcoming the new year in style, Wisconsin Public Radio has programs to get you in the festive spirit. To learn more about all of our seasonal programs, visit wpr.org/holidays.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Palestinian security officials say they've arrested Islamist extremists to prevent potential attacks during the Christmas season in Bethlehem. Daniel Estrin reports the West Bank city is the traditional birthplace of Jesus, and Christian pilgrims visit there each year.
Palestinian security officials say they've arrested a group of Islamic extremists in Bethlehem over concerns about possible threats during the Christmas season. On Christmas Eve, large numbers of armed Palestinian security forces patrolled the busy square in Bethlehem where people gathered to celebrate. Palestinian police also arrested two suspected extremists after a Christmas tree was set on fire in the West Bank.
Daniel Estrin reporting from Jerusalem. Russian military officials say their warplanes have made more than 5,000 sorties in Syria, but Russian officials are denying that any of their airstrikes killed civilians. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports Russian officials are attacking the Amnesty International report.
Russian politicians and officials have been using almost exactly the same language. They're calling the Amnesty report fake, and they say it contains no real evidence. The fact that they're doing this suggests that they are really concerned that this report is going to affect public opinion about their campaign in Syria.
NPR's Corey Flintoff. Wall Street is closed today for the Christmas holiday. Trading resumes on Monday. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. A USDA official says the number of people who are working and receiving food stamps is at its highest level in the nation's food assistance program. As Daniel Kading reports, he's concerned about states like Wisconsin reducing access to benefits.
At least one person has a job, and more than 40% of households receiving federal food stamps, according to Kevin Concannon. The USDA Undersecretary for Food and Nutrition says he worries about states like Wisconsin
that have elected to reduce access to some of these feeding programs when there's a shortage of jobs that will pay sufficient income.
Concannon says states should mix job programs with food assistance, which Wisconsin has done. The state's food stamp program, Food Share, now requires adults without children to enroll in job training to receive benefits. Critics say people who can't find work are dropped from the program, putting pressure on food pantries. Governor Walker has said people won't get kicked off Food Share unless they're not participating in job training or seeking work. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A rare gold coin dropped into a Salvation Army collection kettle could net the charity hundreds of dollars. Lacrosse Corps Major Jack Holloway told the Lacrosse Tribune that this week's donation was made anonymously at the charity's headquarters. He said the coin could be worth $500 once auctioned off. The Red Kettle campaign often produces tales of generosity during the holidays, including one involving a $500,000 check in Minnesota. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the SCAN Foundation, working to advance a coordinated system of high-quality services for older adults that preserve dignity and independence. More information is available at thescanfoundation.org. From American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at ajws.org. And from Americans for the Arts at americansforthearts.org.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. When David McGlynn and his family moved to Wisconsin, they learned about St. Nicholas Day. The tradition confused his son, and in his attempt to explain, McGlynn struggled to reconcile the truth with the magic of childhood.
The year my older son started kindergarten, our third in Wisconsin, I learned about St. Nick's Day. Children set their shoes by the fireplace before bed on December 5th and wake the next morning to find their Keds and Converse filled with chocolate coins wrapped in gold foil, a small toy or two. A parent of the school told me that everyone in Wisconsin celebrated St. Nick's. If our son missed it, he'd feel left out. We didn't want that, did we? We didn't have a fireplace, so our sons left their shoes beneath the thermostat. The next morning, they bounded downstairs and dived for the loot. Two-year-old Hayden sat on the floor and devoured his entire stash of chocolate coins, wrappers and all. At five, though, Galen was puzzled. "Is this Christmas?" he asked. "It's St. Nick's Day," my wife said. "Does St. Nick work for Santa?" Galen asked. "Or does he work for God?" Since becoming a father, I've had my misgivings about propagating the Santa Claus mythology. It's not Santa's make-believe status that bothers me, but rather how children are encouraged to believe in him when they're little, only to have the fable later revealed as a fraud. This was my chance to set a few things straight. "St. Nick was Santa," I said. "He was a real person who lived a long time ago. He was so famous that everyone in Europe knew about him and told stories about him long after he died." "He died?" Galen's eyes widened and his mouth fell open. "A long time ago," I said. "We remember him at Christmas because his story reminds us to be generous." Galen stared at the tree. He looked as though he'd grasped some fundamental human truth about perhaps the way fables can tell us something about who we are and ought to live. I congratulated myself for making the truth plain. I hadn't said Santa wasn't real. On the contrary, Santa was as real as he and I, subject to the same cycles of life and death. But the next week, his teacher called. "We had some trouble today," she said. "We were making ornaments when Galen announced to the class that Santa was dead." Uh-oh. Her tone was unmistakable. Rumors of Santa's demise needed to be dispelled, pronto. I found Galen in the living room watching TV. I sat down and waited for an opportunity to broach the subject. "Hey, kid, remember that conversation we had last week? Turns out I was wrong. There really is a fat guy in a velveteen suit flying reindeer who can squeeze through air ducts." It sounded not only stupid, but cowardly. A bald-faced repeal of the first consequential truth I'd ever told him. I never did find a way to tell Galen that Santa wasn't dead. But without further intervention, he decided to hedge his bets and declare Santa alive again. Believing in Santa is ultimately an act of community during a season when community is paramount. Hoping we've made the nice list helps reassure children that they're worthy of the love, goodwill, and yes, even the presents that come their way during the holidays. It's not Santa's magic that children cling to and need, but but his grace. On Christmas Eve, I ushered the boys upstairs to bed. They kicked their feet inside their sheets and squealed. Santa can't come until you're asleep, I said. Stay in bed. Galen drew an X on his chest. I promise. Merry Christmas, Dad. As I pulled the door shut, I heard him say, I mean, Santa.
David McGlynn is a writer and professor at Lawrence. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org. Stay with us. The Marketplace Morning Report is coming up next, and then the music starts at 9. And for this Christmas Day, there are lots of carols, the Nutcracker Suite, and some great holiday pieces for orchestra. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics here right on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Can you fix diesel engines? Make yourself more marketable and make more money with a diesel equipment technology degree. You'll get certification from Gateway's partner, Snap-on. Get information at gtc.edu.
In Madison, Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support holiday activities that welcome the entire family. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
A cloudy Christmas day in Wisconsin today. Highs will be in the upper 20s to lower 30s in the north, to the upper 30s and around 40 degrees in the south.
Support for WPR comes from The Bolt Company, providing professional construction services to customers in a variety of markets nationwide for more than 125 years. More about markets served, featured projects, and news is at bolt.com.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR, a cultural asset and a community resource. WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College, with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
As you open presents today, companies want to turn your newest gadget from a passing fad into a perennial favorite.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
From APM in New York, I'm Noelle King, and for David Brancaccio. First up, there's news FedEx will be making some deliveries today after bad weather put a kink in the package supply chain. Frustrated customers have taken to the company's Facebook page to complain. Satish Jindal is president of ShipMatrix, which makes software for shipping companies.
These companies' brands are very powerful brands. If you look at consumer surveys that are done, UPS, FedEx rank higher than companies like McDonald's and Coke, for many of them. And protecting that is very critical. However, they find themselves having to defend against the errors of retailers who promote something that they shouldn't be promoting and guaranteeing something that is not a guaranteed service.
He says when a retailer guarantees you that two-day shipping, it's not the retailer you're blaming when it doesn't reach you in time. Tis the season for a big bump in consumer electronics sales. Those of you unwrapping phones, smartwatches, and laptops today will understand exactly why. It's also the season for companies to consider what they can do to make sure their newest gadget stays in style. Marketplace's Wes Williams has the story.
Fitness trackers, smartwatches, and drones, they're all relying heavily on the holiday season this year.
In some technology categories, manufacturers are making up about half of their revenue for the year in the holiday season.
Ben Arnold is a consumer technology analyst for the NPD Group, and he says there is a way companies can survive the doldrums of the rest of the year.
You've got to make sure you sustain that interest in the product with messaging throughout the year, making sure that you hit some of the other holiday periods, particularly in the spring.
But that just gets you through 1 year. Staying relevant after that isn't just a marketing problem. Take wearables, for example. Jonathan Melnick is a senior analyst at Lux Research.
About half the people after a year stop using their activity trackers.
And for that problem, he says, having the best working product is what counts the most. I'm Wes Williams for Marketplace.
Almost exactly 1 year ago, Mark Rosekind was confirmed as head of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, or NHTSA. He said he'd crack down on automakers and bring a new start to the agency. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has been following his progress from Washington. Nancy, what did Rosekind set out to do as NHTSA administrator?
Well, he wanted to give NHTSA some teeth, and just having him confirmed was helpful. NHTSA hadn't had a permanent administrator for more than a year. And in general, Rosekind wanted to send a message to automakers that they needed to be better about reporting defects and issuing recalls.
This comes in the context of some major recalls over the past few years.
That's right. Chrysler recalled some Jeeps because their gas tanks hang low and pose a safety risk. There have been recalls of vehicles with Takata airbags because the airbags could explode. And then there was the problem with ignition switches on some GM vehicles. GM was fined $35 million for not reporting the problem sooner. And that happened before Rosekind took over.
And in the meantime, could he have added teeth to that?
Well, it would have been difficult, actually, because these types of fines are capped at $35 million. I talked with Carl Tobias about this. He's a professor of law at the University of Richmond. He says Rosekind is pressing for higher fines.
He, I think, has requested that Congress raise that cap so that the agency could impose a much larger cap, and in that way send a message to the entire industry that the government will not tolerate violations of these reporting requirements.
So how does the auto industry feel about Rosekind?
They haven't said much publicly, but some auto executives have been quoted anonymously as saying they're afraid he'll overreach. But Tobias told me at least now they'll just be dealing with one person instead of a series of acting administrators.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Angie's List, providing consumers with reviews on local companies for 20 years, committed to protecting members so they can be confident in their decisions about hiring local services. Angie'sList.com.
A major effort is underway in this country to reform the way we sentence men and women who've been convicted of drug-related offenses. Thousands of felons are getting early release, but will there be jobs for them when they get out? Reporter Jacob Lewin found one successful company in Oregon that makes a point of hiring ex-convicts.
Visit the bakery at Dave's Killer Bread outside Portland, and you'll find pumps sucking 2,000 pounds of ingredients into mixing bowls. You'll also find that a third of the company's 300 employees have a criminal past, including plant manager Ronnie Elrod.
We're just so happy to have a job that typically we've got an attitude of gratitude, and we also know that opportunities are going to be hard to come by for us, so we have to take those opportunities that come along, and we really have to make good on them.
And Harvard sociologist Diva Pager says that's true. She's studying the job performance of ex-cons in the military.
Those with serious criminal pasts perform just as well, if not better, than their counterparts with no criminal records. At least with appropriate kinds of screening, individuals with serious criminal records can perform very well in the workplace.
Another of Pager's studies shows that a criminal record seriously reduces the chances of getting a job.
I hired groups of young men to pose as job applicants and sent them all over the city applying for low-wage, low-skill kinds of jobs. And half the time, they reported having a felony conviction. And simply by checking that box, their chances of receiving a callback or job offer were cut in half.
Dave Skiller Brett has hired so many ex-convicts because, well, because of Dave. Dave Dahl, that is. After serving 15 years for drug crimes, Dahl returned to his family's bakery and in 2005 created his namesake bread.
It was based on the epiphany that I had in prison, which was that I could turn my own life around. And eventually the feeling was that we could help others to do the same thing.
The company uses its hiring practices as a selling point, with Dahl's picture on every package, even though a judge put him on conditional release after he rammed into some police cars 2 years ago. This year, Dave's Killer Bread was sold to Flowers Foods for $275 million. In Portland, I'm Jacob Lewin for Marketplace.
And yes, you heard that right. Dave's Killer Bread was bought for $275 million. I'm Noelle King with the Marketplace Morning Report.
This is APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you're having a lovely Christmas morning. Stay with us. We'll have holiday music for you through much of today. You can find our special seasonal programming schedule online at WPR.org. And the news is back at 3 o'clock with All Things Considered.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Kimberly-Clark Corporation, home of Kleenex, Huggies, and Kotex brands. More information about Kimberly-Clark's 143-year history is available on the web at kimberly-clark.com.
Local musicians, get your music on the radio on WGTD's Noon Tunes. It airs Monday through Friday on the WGTD Midday News. Email Dave McGrath at mcgrathd@gtc.edu.
You're listening to WGTD HD.